Oi, oi, it's your boy, Jack Slack, broadcasting to you from the queue where Britain used to be. Yep, it's a bit shit around here at the moment. No petrol anywhere, and then when there is, there's these enormous queues, which isn't a huge issue because I'm not doing a lot of driving, but whenever I am driving, half the road is taken up with a queue for a petrol station, and you have to swerve out around them to try and get through, driving down the wrong side of the road. And at some point I will need petrol, and I'm really not looking forward to having to go and get that. So yes, that's what's going on over here. Definitely nothing to do with Brexit. Just, if you've seen any of these clips of people panic buying, I guarantee that some of these people are the same people who were like, project fear, when everyone was like, well, it could get a bit complicated once we leave the EU. And then immediately go and panic buy. And I bet it's also the same fuckers who are like 50-year-old dudes who are going on about Blitz mentality and how we got through the war. And you're like, you were born 30 years after the war. What are you talking about? But then I can sort of, sympathize or empathize at least, because people have got to be places. And if they're told that like there's going to be a shortage of petrol, people will go and buy petrol or gas, as you call it in America. But it's made me want an electric car. But then I imagine if I got an electric car, we'd run out of something else. In fact, like three power companies in the UK went bust yesterday. So yes, just broadcasting from the end of empire here. But can't get political because someone, I had a great argument with someone on YouTube the other day. I was pretty patient with them, like asking them, what's the matter? And they're going, oh, stop talking about fighter pay. I don't want politics. And I was like, well, it's not really politics. And he was like, yes, it is. And I was like, well, explain how it's politics. Both me and, a very right-wing chap like Tim Kennedy both want better pay for fighters. It's just a case of looking at the sport and saying, like, I think this sport would be better if we paid these fighters more. And we got some of these guys who are going to the NFL and so on to consider coming to MMA and using their athletic talents there. And his answer was that they'd sign contracts, and then if they try and dispute the contracts and they have no money, which they don't, which was a really weird place to start the debate anyway, like being like, yes, they do get underpaid and they are living on the edge of poverty, but if they want to fight the UFC in court, they'll be assigned a court-appointed lawyer, and that takes taxpayer money. It was like the most convoluted everything is linked worldview I've ever heard. I can't get on board with the fighters trying to get paid more. Because welfare queens. But in terms of fighter pay, like, I was hoping for John Jones to get his $15 million to fight Francis Ngannou. I was like, oh, yeah, that fight's probably worth it. But no, he's managed to make an ass of himself this week and just be... I mean, it's not even funny. It's not really. Like, if he was out getting into bar fights, I still wouldn't like it, but it'd still be quite funny. But assaulting your wife, or sorry, fiancé, until your own kids call the police. No, that's not funny at all. So as good as like the idea, and this is the thing, like you always try and separate the fighter the person from the performance and so on. And I'm always going to be able to use John Jones as an amazing example of technical ability and game planning. But at this point, I don't think like, why would you want to see him get a big payday to fight Francis Ngannou or anyone, Dude is just awful. And the best part is, like, we all knew he was a sociopath from the beginning. Like, just the way that he constantly lies about, like, I'm going to make big changes to my life now. But everything is always framed as, like, God is testing me. Like, how did he test you? I don't feel like it's a test to not assault people or commit crimes, to be honest. And if you're incredibly wealthy, how do you do that? How do you, like, turn the crime into I had to do it event. You're not Aladdin stealing bread and then giving it to children. You're some loser who pretends to be in the militia and fires guns in urban areas. But it is getting a bit awkward because obviously Dana White, the famous quote that everyone keeps digging up is like, you don't come back from hitting a woman, which he said about Will Chope. And obviously Will Chope, like, it wasn't a huge loss to the sport when they kicked him out of the UFC. But every time Rumble's accused, every time someone else gets arrested doing something horrible, they bring this up. And I mean, yeah, rightly so. Like, don't pretend that there's a moral standard that your fighters need to reach. If you're then going to be like, well, I also recognize that Jon Jones sells over 500,000 pay-per-views, which in this day and age is a lot. But I mean, it's actually pretty bad, like how common domestic violence is among fighters. Like it came up in the fucking New York hearings, which I wrote an article on when they happened, but it's probably gone from Fightland now. But these New York hearings were amazing. It's like, if you ever want to be convinced that your local representative doesn't know shit, listen to them talk about something you actually know about. Because like most of the time I go like, oh yeah, they probably know better than me. And then they start talking about MMA. And it's clear that they're all speaking with absolute confidence about something they know nothing about. There was this woman going like, I will support legalizing MMA in New York because my nephews, they both have the nunchucks. They love the nunchucks. Then there's another woman being like, how will this bill protect children? And the guy had to stand up and be like, well, children won't be signing to fight for money. This is to get professional MMA through. Amateur MMA is already legal. And then there was some like old black dude who got up and was like, you know how we feel about the chokehold in New York City. It's just like, it was a very race-baity way to frame it. But even in those hearings, someone stood up and said, why is there so much spousal abuse and domestic violence among MMA fighters? And the people on the defending end had to be like, I don't know. Like, it is astonishingly common in this sport, and it's not good. But yeah, that was the big news story this week. Jon Jones was arrested again for domestic violence and headbutting a police car, apparently to do with the booze. Put out an Instagram statement, which was literally a video of him bench pressing with, oh fuck, what was the music playing in the background? It was funny, whatever it was. And just being like, Jesus is testing me again. You know, I mean, I'm laughing, but it's pretty gross. So yeah, quite content if he doesn't get into the heavyweight mix at any point. You know, they don't let him come back and fight Jan at light heavyweight or whatever. But then, you know, on the opposite end of that, I mean, Francis Ngannou has not committed any crimes, but except for the crime of wanting more money. And the UFC said, fuck it, your belt doesn't mean anything anymore. We give it and we take away. And now Cyril Gane has an interim belt, which means, well, I mean, it means that it's the real belt if Francis Ngannou gets into a prolonged contract negotiation or dispute. But anyway, I mean, how did that come about? Oh, we were rambling about how I can't get petrol or how I was queuing behind petrol buyers this morning. Let's talk a bit about the stuff that I watched this week just to break it up. And then we'll talk about some news, and then we'll talk about the fights coming up this weekend, whatever there is going on. What did I watch? Oh, I promised to talk about Valentina versus Lauren Murphy, but I'm not going to. Usyk versus Joshua was a lot of fun. It was interesting because I think I said on the last one, when I briefly touched on the pre-fight, I can't remember the last southpaw that Joshua fought, and I don't think he's fought like a really notable southpaw. I'm trying to think of notable southpaw heavyweights. You know, I don't follow it super closely, but I know that Luis Ortiz is very good, and that's about it. But I mean, Tyson Fury goes southpaw sometimes, but he's not really a southpaw. So it was going to be interesting seeing how Joshua dealt with that. Obviously, the size difference was going to be big because Usyk is coming up from cruiserweight, and Anthony Joshua, you know, could never make cruiserweight if he cut off a leg. The guy is a colossus at that weight. Actually, I knew people who used to play rugby against him when he was a skinny beanpole, and then he took up boxing and packed on mass. But yeah, I mean, the Usyk thing is just the same old story as it's always been. World-class light heavyweight. Well, I mean, you know, it used to be light heavyweight. They didn't have cruiserweight until quite recently. But world-class light heavyweight or cruiserweight, too small to be a heavyweight most of the time, but does everything they can at their own weight, and then says, oh, fuck it, I want the money now. I'm cashing out. Let's go for it. Let's do the heavyweight thing. And a couple of them have had success. Quite a few of them haven't had success, because at the end of the day, it does, you know, a good big man is going to beat a good smaller man. And at any time, there's normally like one good heavyweight in the world or two. You know, it's not all bums, but there are an awful lot of bums in that division. But I thought Usyk looked, well, I thought both of them looked good, actually. I don't want to take too much away from Joshua. A lot of people have a lot of opinions on how Joshua fought, but I thought he given how hard he was struggling in the early rounds, I thought he did very well pulling himself back into it. And then Usyk really turned on even further in the later rounds. Very early on, like, Usyk's movement was incredible, because I've seen him fight a lot, and I remember watching him fight at cruiserweight, and he moved well, but he was mainly like, what most people thought of him at cruiserweight was, damn, that dude's a hitter, and you know, quick, but a hitter as well. And then he came up to heavyweight and he's fighting Joshua, you know, and hasn't been tested an awful. He had a fight before. Oh no, wait, fuck, he was supposed to fight Tyron Spong tested positive for drugs, which is like, well done, Spong. That was your big shot. Just like, how did you manage to do that? And then like a week later, it came out that he was going to be bankrupt because he's paying to feed his pet tigers or some shit like that. Just living the world champion lifestyle without the belt. But actually, we'll link back to that when we talk about Kyotaro later, who turned up in K1, which was an interesting surprise for me. But I think Usyk took one at heavyweight, didn't he? But anyway, yes, the question was like, you know, how's that going to go up? If he was a power a hitter at cruiserweight, now he's fighting guys who are 20, 30 pounds bigger than him, how's that going to hold up? And, you know, speed is still a killer, and that's what you saw in the early rounds. I was just amazed by his movement, though. He'd bounce in and bounce out, and he'd do that, like, in and out, but, you know, slightly off to the right or slightly off to the left, what we call a V-step sometimes. And he'd slap... you know, he'd do like a knife hand block, you know, slap Joshua's hand out, or he'd come in from the outside and slap it in. And he had Joshua's lead hand going all over the place. The hand fight in this was really nice from Usyk. Usyk, sorry. People get mad at me for calling him Usyk. And it really was just a lesson in how much of fighting is anticipation and kidology, you know, just being able to read or make a good guess of what someone's going to do or how they're going to react. You know, you slap the hand in, they reach out, you slap the hand out, you pull the hand down, you know that it's going up again, so you punch the body, you know, you pull the hand down again, they think you're going to punch the body, so you punch the head. Those little, like, things that chain up and really wear on a man. So there was a really nice shot in, like, the third or fourth where Usyk pumped the double jab. Joshua ignored it because he'd been getting bamboozled by feints, but the double jab didn't hit him. So Usyk pumped another double jab. He went double jab, left straight. You know, like four jabs in a row, left straight. And the left straight landed flush. And, you know, Joshua took a fantastic shot in this one, I think. But yes, I mean, if you want to watch just brilliant southpaw movement, that the first sort of four rounds of this are really peak of that. Did a lot more combination work in the later going. There's a lot more standing around to throw punches, because that's the thing, like, as great as anyone, you know, as great as he is, as great as Cyril Garn is moving his feet, like, these guys do slow down through the rounds, because everyone slows down through the rounds. It's just a lot more noticeable for a heavyweight, because they often, like, they'll do one round of bouncing and then they'll come down and be flat-footed. But I thought he managed to maintain his spring quite well through the fight, you know, moving around 220 or 230, whatever he is. It's insane that the heavyweight limit, it used to be 190. I think they moved the cruiserweight in and moved it up, didn't they? But 190 used to be the heavyweight limit, lower limit, that is, or the upper limit of light heavyweight. And that's fucking tiny. there's a lot of UFC welterweights who are well in excess of 190 a lot of the time. But then people have gotten bigger. That's the lesson there. People, nutrition, people be getting bigger. But Joshua managed to do well in the middle rounds, and he was pulling himself back in. Lovely wide right or right uppercut to the body, which is a great open stance weapon, the rear uppercut to the body. Love it. It looks a bit weird because it's quite a long uppercut. So you all that, like, worrying about the danger on that same side, like you would, from the other side. So like a left hook when you're throwing a right uppercut. And danger from the same side as the uppercut, you know, because it's a big movement that you're locking your arm into. It was working well for him. Who was I watching do that beautifully? Oh, Javonte Davis. His last one was just left uppercuts. He's a southpaw, so left uppercuts to the body constantly. Or Floyd Mayweather versus Maidana 2. Two of the big changes he made in that fight, getting Kenny Bayless in as the ref, so that when he threw his arms around Maidana, Kenny Bayless told them to stop, and then he'd hold for a few more seconds as Kenny Bayless told them to break. Whereas previously, I think it was Joe Martinez was the ref. Oh no, who was it? Fuck. Bird? I think Bird's actually quite a good ref. But it was one of the guys who just let them work. And it was the same guy who refed Mayweather Cotto. And if you remember Mayweather keeps clinching Cotto. And Cotto is one of the few fighters in the world who won't accept a clinch. it's one of the things in boxing, like it's been bred out of people. Because refs are so worried about the clashes of heads, the infight is pretty much dead for the most part. If you tie someone up, you know, if they're a brilliant two-handed hitter and you throw your arms around them, suddenly they're not. And if you watch fights with like Rocky Marciano back in the day, because one of his big problems was people trying to tie him up because he was so short and obviously trying to get in close with them. But you watch Marciano, Henry Armstrong, any of those old infighters where they were doing as much wrestling as they were hitting. Get your head in front of theirs, get your hips back and punch through the space that's between your chests. And that's what Cotto did wonderfully against Mayweather. But anyway, sorry, we're talking about the rear uppercut open stance situation. Love it. He was doing an interesting thing, actually, with his right hand, where he was throwing his right hand, but he was just sort of like throwing it as if to throw straight and then sort of looping it around and slapping with it at the end. So it was just a little paw. Reminded me of one of Naz's best punches, where I think it's called like a thumb feint or something like that. Don Familton has a good bit on it in one of his videos, which are great if you want to learn more about boxing and you don't want to pay any money. They're on YouTube for free. But he had this feint where basically you got your right hand by your chin, obviously, ready to parry punches or take left hooks on it. And instead of like doing a big feint with your shoulders and body, you just turn your hand down. So the opponent sees your hand turning over, probably earlier than you would in an actual punch. But they just see that little feint and they react to it. But Naz used to do that with, he'd be able to show people the right straight. And then he'd loop it round so that it came in as like a long right hook or swing. And he'd catch dudes just on the end of it as they were reaching out to parry and knock him down. He knocked down Kevin Kelly like that. And that was something that Brendan Ingle was big on, changing the path of punch during the punch. There was a great one. Who was the guy? Not Robinson. Who was the other guy that he won his title from? But he shows him like an overhand and he changes it to an uppercut, like a big loaded up right uppercut. As the guy ducks into it. It's absolutely fantastic. Naz was very good at that. But anyway, yes, it was like that. Joshua was throwing like a what looked like a right straight, but then he'd loop it around and slap him with the glove on the end. And it was interesting because it was working really well. It was catching him because he'd lean out side of the right straight and he'd just get slapped across the chin with the glove. And it was a good shout because like by taking power off his shots and just trying to catch Usyk, he was doing a better job of finding Usyk. You know, Usyk was probably very well prepared for big counterpunches because Joshua is the banger. And by taking it back to like the amateurs and being like, well, I'm going to try and land some points on him now. I've got to get some points on the board. Joshua actually pulled himself back into the fight a little bit and got himself, you know, because what Usyk was doing was beating him in like a point contest, but the punches hurt. that's all that like really good amateur boxing is. Once you convert it into the professional ranks, you're scoring points, but you're hurting them. So by taking it back into sort of like an amateur point scoring contest and just doing little tricks like that, Joshua was actually doing pretty well. Lots of interesting takes on this, like Joshua should have just walked him down, you know, because the assumption is Joshua was the bigger man and he should have used it. And you're like, no, dude. Did you see how fast that left straight was? Like he didn't walk him down because that left straight would be hitting him on the chin every time he stepped in. You know, there's like he could go back to the drawing board and try and apply more pressure in a rematch and corner him, but there's a lot of defensive work that needs to be done there. And if you're already getting hit by the left straight a lot, you know, it's a bad time to be like, well, I'll just walk through it because it doesn't matter if you're 30 pounds heavier, the guy's still banging. But yes, it was good fun. If you want to check it out, I mean, you should check it out, actually. He's a very, very skilled fighter, Usyk. He brought out a good fight from Joshua, and it was just good high-level boxing at heavyweight, which you very seldom see. I mean, Usyk versus Fury, I mean, that's a very strange fight to think about. But I mean, it is annoying that they managed to fuck it again, the all-British heavyweight unification fight. I mean, you know... With that, probably a lot of my listeners aren't British, so they're not like hugely interested in that. But can you imagine how big an event that would be? You could put it on in Wembley. You could put it on. I mean, you could put it on in any stadium in the UK, and you'd sell it out instantly. You could have a great world title fight, not at American times. you know, it was a license to print money, and they still managed to fuck it somehow. And I understand that part of it is Wilder activating his rematch clause, which Joshua has now activated against Usyk. It is one of the most annoying things about professional boxing, and one of the things that thankfully we're spared by the UFC's monopoly. You know, I said that rolling my eyes while I said that. Can you hear my eyes rolling? It was quite a heavy roll. Maybe it was audible. But, you know, one of the yes, it's bad that the UFC has a monopoly, but with these people who are like, oh, I want the Ali Act and I want every fight to be negotiated individually, like in boxing, you're going like, well, no, because in boxing, if you are the underdog in a title fight, and if you're talking about a good world champion, that's every, you know, challenger in a title fight. If you win, you have to win twice. It's just automatic at this point. And maybe you don't remember, but like there was a period where there was a lot of immediate rematches in the UFC and people were livid about it. It basically ended about the time that Jose Aldo lost his belt to Conor McGregor. And they were like, yeah, no, we don't need an automatic rematch for that. You're like, you gave Johnny Hendricks and Robbie Lawler an automatic rematch and you tried to do a third one before people got angry at you. Why can the best featherweight of all time not get a rematch for the 13-second knockout? Actually, on the subject of that, I just published Advanced Striking 2.0 Jose Aldo, which was really good fun to write, specifically focusing on three pivots and how they affected different areas of his fights. And you should definitely go check that out if you're not. At any rate, that's the Lennox Lewis derby off the table. We're not getting Fury versus Joshua anytime soon. Fury's locked into Wilder 3. You know, a fight no one gives a shit about except Wilder. And I do hope that, I hope that Wilder can get it done? Because like that's further time between unifying the titles. It's just boxing being boxing. You know, everything's a fucking state. Anytime it looks like, oh, there's no way they possibly can't unify the titles now. It's just, nope, not going to happen. And I suppose, you know, it's in the interest of these losers who run, you know, boxing boards or the people who make up the, I don't know, gigantic offices of the World Boxing Organization or the World Boxing Council or the International Boxing Federation. Just like 10 losers each who put some money together to get some belts. But they don't want to recognize the same people because then their belt doesn't mean anything. They want the belts as many places as possible. And they want to be netting a 250 grand licensing fee like they tried to get from Miguel Cotto. And he was like, fuck it, I'll drop that belt. Which is the correct way to talk about it. Like, you go, I'm already the number one ranked according to the Ring magazine and anyone who gives a shit. So, no, fuck it. I'm not going to pay $250,000 to have your belt on. What are you going to do? Put it on someone worse than me? And they did. So that was a bit of fun. And then I was catching up on the Contender Series. Bit of a rough one this week. It was four fights on the card, which is a little bit like, anyway. And then I noticed, like, because I pull up the fights, you know, the wiki listing so that I can work out who's who. And you know, honestly, just so I can see if there's any finishes. But there were two signed this week, two fighters signed. They've signed five for like the last 3 or 4 weeks. So I was going, oh God, these fights must be bad. And they kind of were, but even the ones that they signed were not great. Actually, there was a good one between Daniel Zeluba versus Lucas Almeida. That was good fun. If you want to watch a decent fight, go watch it. Honestly, they should have just signed both of them. But otherwise, it was like light heavyweights holding onto the fence, heavyweights leaning on each other. I mean, I will say I enjoy Felder and Sanko in the booth together. I think they're very good. And I think I said last time, like Sanko seems to be, you know, I don't want to say like it's, like she seems to want to be justifying her position or something like that, because I'm sure there are weirdos out there who are like, a woman on commentary? This is absurd. She should be walking around the ring in her underpants. You know, she acts like she, you know, wants to justify being there, as in like she does her research and she really does. It shows. It's like, I mean, and I'm not saying that in like a, well, fuck it. This is the boy cast. No one's going to take me out of context and be like, Jack Slack, sexist, ? But I was going to say, it's exactly like Brian Stan. And that's what I used to love about Stan. He did his fucking research and he cared about who he was watching fight. And I suppose that's harder to do if you're doing more and more fights. But Stan managed to keep it up until he ultimately moved on to do something else. I think he's doing activism of some kind, isn't he? Don't know, but he's awesome. And yes, Sanko's pretty good at that too. And she was like, the heavyweights that come out and she goes like, well, one of these lads has a record that is all knockouts and very impressive, but each of the opponents are like 0-5, 0-10. And it was interesting, like, you got into, like, the, you know, how numbers don't mean what they always mean, don't mean what they look like they mean, rather, and so on. And she's pretty good at, like, talking about ground positions and saying, like, this is why they do that. And by her doing that, Felder does that too. You know, I think Felder's a very competent commentator. I like Felder a lot. Even we had a brief beef on Twitter because I was like, Paul Felder's jokes are bad or something like that. It was clever when I wrote it, but he does name search himself and get angry about it. But, you know, I've always liked Paul Felder as a fighter, and I think he's actually done a pretty good job as a commentator. I think he's dragged down when, like, DC wants to do the screaming and talking about people who've died booth. It's like DC very competent at, you know, obviously he knows a lot because he fucking fought at an incredibly high level, but he can also articulate it very well when they're talking about stuff like that. And that's what they should be doing. That you're there as the fighter. Talk about, like, what the fighter's experience is like. Talk about what you would be wanting to do from here. Talk about why it's not working. It's just like, you know, he wants to do the same thing. Like, it's especially bad when he's on with Joe because he wants to do the screaming and like, be Joe Rogan's double act. But I thought Sanko and Felder were really good together here. And I've said that last week too. The only downside is they keep bringing in this gambling dude to talk about the line, and you're like, you don't do this on the pod, you don't do this on the real broadcast when the fights actually matter. Why are you doing it on this one? I suppose, actually, that does make sense. I suppose because a lot of the people who actually care enough to watch Dana White's Contender Series are not interested in finding up-and-coming fighters. They're, like, jonesing for something to bet on. It's Tuesday, and I need to bet. I made a very R-worded bet last weekend. I put a parlay on Nick Diaz and Lauren Murphy. So I was like, how much can I get if these two win? And it was something like 21-1 or something like that. It was incredible. And then, of course, both of them got their asses kicked. So I was like, oh, yeah, that really was an R-worded bet. But one day one of these stupid bets will pay off, and I will make enough back that covers basically all the stupid bets that I've made. It doesn't actually improve my life at all. But yeah, the sole good moments of that, well, I mean, I told you the fight that was good, but the main event was just like two light heavyweights grabbing the fence over and over again. And then the opener was two heavyweights just being big, useless heavyweights. But there was a nice moment in that heavyweight fight where they were in an over-under against the fence. The guy on the inside of the fence who's leaning on the other guy reaches down, picks up a high crotch that's kind of useless, but he turns the guy off the fence and he turns him all the way around. So the guy's hopping on one leg, defending the takedown, like no effort. But the moment that the guy's back comes around to the fence again, he does like a full 360 around the guy hopping on one leg. The moment that his back comes to the fence again, the guy who's on the crap high crotch comes up and is on the body lock and he's suddenly taken his back. So he went from like an over-under to a body lock through through a full 360 spin on this leg. It was really interesting. And then what else did I... Oh, I was watching bits of, not all of, the recent K1 Grand Prix. If you don't know, K1 K1 used to be all heavyweights because that was... I mean, it was basically like an open absolute tournament. They started doing lower weight classes at their... It was the K1 Max, wasn't it? And then they went bankrupt and Glory bought all the heavyweights. And, you know, at the same time, a lot of the best heavyweights or the old golden era heavyweights were done, basically. And they were replaced by people like Jamal Ben Sadiq, who just like, no, it's not the same as having like Peter Ayats, Ernesto Hoost, Andy Hug, Semi Schild, you know, just all these amazing guys in the same tournaments. You know, we could, even guys like Mike Bernardo would be top of the heap today, but he was just like a middle of the pack guy in the golden age. But basically K1 went bankrupt, Glory took over with the heavyweights, but K1 has managed to rebuild itself really nicely with like young Japanese talent. I suppose it's kind of what Rizin is sort of doing, but it's not very good, Rizin. Like, it's full of Japanese MMA guys who just aren't that great, but for some reason all these like young karateka and Thai boxers who've grown up in Japan, just they've all arrived at the same point at the same time, and the NK1's actually pretty good now. And, you know, Japanese kickboxing is a big thing on its own anyway. You know, obviously K1 is the daddy of them all, but Tenshin Nasukawa is probably one of the most famous kickboxers in the world, and I don't think he's ever fought in K1. But the weird thing about K1 now is that, like, because they really focus on the lower weight classes, they did one heavyweight Grand Prix a while ago, but it was just, like, guys who really weren't that special. But they focus on the lower weight classes, but they really do. They've got like so many fucking weight classes and belts now. It's getting to boxing points. Because this was for a 67 kilo title, I think, which was welterweight. And one of the guys in it was the K1 65 kilo champion, which is like, you know, 4 pounds difference. Takeru has two different belts for different weights that are like 5 pounds apart. But, you know, if it gets us more tournaments, I love tournaments. And the main reason that I watched this was that I saw people talking about Noiri, who I have always adored. There was an old piece I did for Fightland, which was one of those like three more strikers you really need to be watching pieces. And I waxed lyrical about Noiri there. When did I first see Noiri? Oh, I was in Japan. I was in Tokyo at the Ariake Coliseum or whatever it is for Glory something or other. I didn't travel all the way to Tokyo to watch Glory, but it was on while I was in Tokyo. So I was like, damn, I'm going. And he was outside getting a churro before the undercard started. And I was like, okay. I saw his face. I didn't recognize him from the fight. And then I saw him inside fighting. And I was like, that dude was just outside eating a churro. Because he was also like a child. It was him and Yuta Kubo, who had to be like 18 years old at the time. But yeah, I've been keeping an eye on his career since then. You know, I drift in and out because it is, honestly, I know like a lot of my listeners will be going, oh, fucking get some tech savvy, Jack. But it is annoying to try and keep up with K1. It's quite difficult. Like you have to get a Beamer, which is like the Netflix of Japan. And obviously it's all in Japanese, so you have to translate the whole page and try and work out roughly what things mean. Like if you want to use a Russian torrent site or whatever. But I managed to watch this one. I managed to get a hold of it afterwards. I only watched the Noiri fights and a couple of others. The tournament fights is what I watched and a couple of others, mainly because I wanted to watch Noiri. But Noiri's been... It's interesting because he had a little... He was an amazing finisher. He has this very interesting style that's very Kyokushin-y. Maybe Sado. One of those like knockdown karate styles. He's got very weird kicks. Very dexterous kicks. And they're like... They're not like Muay Thai kicks, you know. They're not like big round baseball bat swings. They often snap, they hinge at the knee a lot. But sometimes they don't, and they come at weird angles. But he's always been a really good finisher. And then he went on a little streak a while ago. Like from his last loss, he had like four or five decisions. And then he came in for this tournament and knocked out everyone he fought. You know, three different fights in one night, knocked them all out. And he looked incredible doing it. I'm saying to you now, go and find this through whatever means you can. But his run in this tournament is insane. His kicking is awesome on the outside, but his inside game is really interesting too because he definitely does cover up. He relies on the double forearm guard too much, which annoys me. Like that's one of the things that I don't enjoy about kickboxing. So many dudes. I think it's largely the Dutch influence because they do a lot of Dutch drilling and they do a lot of hard sparring. You know, day by day where they just, you cover up and then you come back when the other guy, like the worst person or like the best example of this style, which I hate, is Robin van Roosmalen, who literally covers up, takes the blows, comes back with four and then a low kick, you know? And the idea is that he lands more punches in his flurries and then you land your flurries on his guard and then he lands his flurries again. And it's a horrible style for anything where you don't have the very large gloves. It's a horrible style for anything where you've got to worry about where your feet are afterwards, as in like takedowns or clinches. It really is just made for kickboxing without the clinch, without elbows, you know, especially without elbows, because if guys put on the earmuffs in a venue where elbows are allowed, you literally just put your hands on their forearms and turn over an elbow, and you've got a great chance of cutting them open. Who was it? Oh, Vicente Luque versus Brian Barbarena. How far are we in? 40 minutes and I'm already losing it. Barbarena's walking him down and putting on the earmuffs, and Vicente Luque's having a hard time knocking him out because it's Brian Barbarena and he takes a phenomenal shot. So finally, Vicente Luque works out that he can turn over his elbows and he starts cutting him up. Same with Diaz McGregor too. But yes, Masaaki Noiri does too much of that earmuff stuff. But when he goes to the inside, his punching is like rapid fire punching combinations in fighting style, and he tends to square his stance out and use lots of sidesteps. So he'll get his opponent to the ropes, he'll square his stance, he'll throw his hands, and then he'll sidestep to his right and end up in southpaw and start throwing like his left up the middle. So it's a really interesting style of fighting, but like, because, you know, if he comes from like a Sado or Kyokushin background, you know, that sort of boxing isn't really what they do. You know, there's no head punches, and the fights are generally just like exchanging body shots until a high kick comes up. But he's made this interesting style of boxing for himself. So his first fight of the night was great. He looked really sharp. He cornered the guy on the ropes and he stepped in for a knee. And Noiri's knees have always been like my favorite thing about him, because he throws his knees. Well, it's another sort of like knockdown karate thing. You can knee guys in the head, but you can't pull their head down. You can't hold on to the head. You can't hang on them in any way. So guys like Norichaka do great jumping knees. They'll like do a little sidestep to the side and then bring the knee up really high next to their own shoulder. But Noiri will like jump up and bring in the knee from the side. He'll curve it in at head height. And when I watched him at Glory 8, he was against Liam Harrison, who obviously is a very famous British Muay Thai fighter, very skilled. And Harrison was giving him trouble. And then Noiri saw that Harrison's back touched the ropes. He stepped in, threw a knee, slashed Harrison's face wide open. Harrison was livid, because obviously he'd keep fighting if he could, but the doctors were like, no, you can't fight if half your face is hanging off. But Noiri stepped in on this lad in the first round with a knee and misses his face, and he puts the knee down in front of him and steps back. So he's in southpaw instead of orthodox. He goes from a right knee from orthodox, misses, puts it down, leans back into southpaw, and as the guy comes off the ropes, he cracks him with a southpaw left straight and drops him. Absolutely gorgeous. And in the second round, he fought, I think it was an Indian lad, but we were talking about triangle kicks and crescent kicks last week when we were talking about Robbie Lawler versus Nick Diaz, and how they are sort of similar things. Like, I think the terms can be used interchangeably, to be honest. But the idea is like, when you do a lot of front snap kicking, and when your round kicks are quite snap kicky, like hinge at the knee anyway, you just like adjust the angle somewhere in the middle and you're going to confuse people. And Noiri, he teeps this guy with a front kick to the midsection, and then steps up immediately and digs in a triangle kick. And it's absolutely gorgeous. It comes in like, basically, so if you rested your shin on the outside of a guy's elbow and then turned your foot enough so that your toes were touching his liver, like, that's the kick you're doing. It's dangerous, because you could, obviously the thing that everyone's scared of is getting their foot spiked on an elbow anyway, but you're really just going like, the shape of my foot is going to perfectly slide around his elbow, and it takes some fucking balls to do. But you can see the value of it, because immediately the guy starts crunching over and his hands are dropping and he's like trying to stay up, but no, he swarms in on him and knocks him down. And then in the final, he has three rounds against this lad. Hang on, I'm gonna look up his name, because he was good. Or he did well, rather. Anpo. So he's in against this guy, Anpo, who's long and tall and awkward, and keeps like throwing up side kicks and things. And he's trying to corner him, and he's getting punched quite a lot in the process. And then he finally corners him in the third round, and he goes left hook, right uppercut, left hook to the liver. The fastest you've ever seen. He just goes tap, tap, tap. And the guy goes down, clutching his liver. And then the next two knockdowns are just Noiri walking up to him and triangle kicking him in the liver. he's like, is my foot going straight or is it going to curve slightly? You guess. and he gets the finish. And I don't know if there's a lot of beef amongst Japanese kickboxers, but he gloated over pretty much every Japanese fighter that he beat, but was fine with the Indian dude. But it was really interesting, because obviously this tournament came together apparently because Yuta Kubo was the champion and retired last year. And my response to that is good, because I fucking hated watching Yuta Kubo fight. And it didn't help that he was quite good at beating Masaki Noiri. I think they had three or four fights, didn't they? Hold on. Yeah, they had three fights. But Kubo was like a really annoying southpaw who would occasionally throw a back kick and hit you in the groin. But he was also hilarious, because he was married to, I think, a model. And he would get drunk and air their, like, his pathetic life on Twitter. he's the best kickboxer in the world. And he's like, he's typing into Twitter his attempts to Google search, like, why does my wife not love me and stuff. there's dudes in the J-Kick community on Twitter who still have the screenshots. So go and find him. But it was so weird. It was absolutely pathetic. And like, she played into it. She'd be like, me and my husband are having bad times right now. I don't think he's man enough for me. And you're like, this is really weird. And then they broke up. So it was clearly not like them doing an act to get attention. They genuinely did divorce. But yeah, this tournament was great fun. I think every fight finished with a knockout, which is one of the great things about J-Kick. They go and knock each other out. You don't have to know who anyone is. They're all just Japanese dudes with bleach blonde hair. Or a big braid in. That's the other one. You know, oh, how am I going to stand out from everyone else? I'll put a big braid in my hair. Or I'll come to the ring with the Thai headband, like that lad, the amazing Eddie Bravo story about his fighter who was great at jiu-jitsu, but like trained with a Muay Thai coach for a month, and he came out and was doing the Y crew in the UFC. Lumpini ready. It's called Lumpini ready. Look it up on YouTube. But then the other weird shit about that K1 event was that, firstly, Satoshi Ishii, the judoka and sort of like mid-tier MMA heavyweight, good enough to headline events, bad enough to lose to a 45-year-old crow cop. But he took his first kickboxing match, you know, striking not being the thing that he's good at, against a guy who once challenged for the K1 cruiserweight title, and I think he won. So that was a bit weird. I'm not recommending you watch it, it was shite. But the other one was Kyotaro came back, who is another interesting story. You know, I mentioned him earlier when we mentioned Tyron Spong, because we were talking about kickboxers chasing the money in heavyweight boxing. Kyotaro, yeah, he left a while ago, probably about 10, 12 years ago he left kickboxing. I think his last fight was against Musasi, actually, because Musasi is actually like the lineal K1 heavyweight champion. Basically, Kyotaro had fought Semi-Schilt to a decision something like 20 days before, and then they were like, you're fighting Musasi on New Year's Eve. It was a similar situation to how Badr Hari lost to Alistair Overeem on New Year's Eve. And everyone was like, damn, kickboxing isn't even that good. And you're like, well, no, he did fight like the tournament 2 weeks ago. You know, it's just a standard Musasi fight. There's always an asterisk next to it. But Kyotaro, he left for boxing and then he came back, which was weird. Apparently this was his second fight back. Didn't look good. It's kind of sad. But he has, his kickboxing run was a bit weird, but he basically did the Lyoto Machida strategy in K1. And it carried him to a couple of really impressive wins. I mean, he almost beat Semi-Schilt, despite being the smallest heavyweight in K1 against the biggest heavyweight in K1. Knocked out Melvin Manhoef and Peter Ayats. He managed to walk them onto punches. You know, his style was, like I said, the Machida thing. He just didn't do anything and drew people forwards. And eventually they'd step in for a combination or chase into the ropes or try and chase into the ropes. And instead of going backwards, he'd come forwards with his right hand, just a good right straight on the chin, and knock him out. So not worth watching. It was just like, it was interesting for me because I thought he left kickboxing too early. I was like, I don't think he should have left kickboxing at all. I think like a lot of these guys waste their time going to boxing because, you know, for every Deontay Wilder who takes up boxing at like 27, you know, there are also a lot of not Deontay Wilders that you've never heard of. And there are also a lot of guys who actually did come up boxing as an amateur and just happened to grow into big dudes. You know, that's the really dangerous thing. Like Tyson Fury. He was already a kid who was obsessed with boxing and training all the time. He just happened to grow into a 6'11 giant. I think there's a, it's kind of wrongheaded to start with a giant dude and be like, well, you could be heavyweight champion. That's like the Great White Hope era where just anyone who was big, their mum would be like, you've got to go and get that belt off that awful Jack Johnson. Show him that the white race is superior. But then I'm the same. Like if I'm at a party talking about my job or whatever, if I'm talking with a big lad, I'll be like, what's your reach? I could probably make something out of you. So yeah, that's the sort of stuff that I watched this weekend. Since the weekend, it was pretty good. Don't know if we'll bother doing any news because it's just things like Valentina Shevchenko asking for the Nunes fight again. Actually, there's a couple of interesting. They're talking about doing Dominic Cruz versus Pedro Munhoz, which is interesting because Munhoz was saying he wanted to go down to flyweight. There was an interesting thing about Yuri Samosh getting mad about one not offering him any fights, which I've heard from, I think Gary Tonin was a bit mad about that a while ago. In fact, that's why he turned up at ADCC and won a medal. Like he'd never won a medal at ADCC. He'd basically moved on. And you either get an invite for ADCC or you qualify. There's a set number of invitations and a set number of qualifications for each division. And I think Gary mostly had to qualify for his other ones. But he was waiting on a fight from one, and so he said, I can't make ADCC. And then he basically called them back and was like, there is no fight now. Can I still have an invite? And they said, sure. Turned up, won bronze, I think, in his division. Or was it silver? He did well, but then they got him another fight, and now they booked him for a title fight. But yes, it seems to be that guys just can't get enough fights in one, which is weird because they're always doing events. And they're always loaded with, like, kickboxers. You know, just give the dudes, just give the good dudes more fights. We'd love to see them. But Yuri Samosh was having a go about it, which is interesting because Yuri Samosh has had one fight in one. And it was very strange because I've probably said this before, but he's a good wrestler in no-gi. And they gave him some guy that I'd never heard of, and he couldn't get him off his feet. It was crazy. But Buchecha debuted the other day, and he fought Anderson Braddock Silva, you know, not the good Anderson Silva. The Anderson Silva who's made his career by sounding a bit like the other Anderson Silva. But obviously kickboxer, like 1-3 record in MMA, and Buchecha immediately takes him down. You know, it was what was expected. But one also announced that Seohi Ham is out of that tournament, so that was a controversial decision. And it turns out they didn't have to take it to the board. Seohi Ham's just out. And then in the time that it took me to say that, they've just announced that Seohi Ham is going to rematch Chumbawamba, whatever her name was, the lass who beat her, to decide who goes forward in the tournament again. So anyway, fights this weekend. Tomorrow there's a Bellator event and a Cage Warriors event. Cage Warriors actually have three events on this weekend, which is good. This is quite interesting because Bellator has rocked up into London and they're advertising on the Tube basically just this one fight. And they've reached that stage of, you know, they're trying to be the UFC, but 10 years ago is what they were always trying to do. And they've reached the phase of UFC where you put on a London card, you have one fight with a British name in as the headliner, and then you phone it the fuck in for the rest of the fights. And that's what this Bellator card is looking like at the moment. You know, I'm pretty... I don't follow British MMA super closely. I know some people in the scene, but... I'm not like watching every event, but I'm looking down this list of names and I'm not like blown away. They got Jack Grant, who's good, from Cage Warriors versus Nathan Jones. Yeah, so basically your main event is the thing that matters. They got Douglas Lima versus Michael Page. And honestly, you know, I'm probably going to lean towards Michael Page given how Lima's looked lately. Douglas Lima is incredibly frustrating because he is basically becoming Tyron Woodley. You know, he could have won both fights against Rory McDonald if he'd done enough. And the second fight with Rory McDonald was basically completely done as a high-level fighter. You know, he was gun-shy. Jesus was stopping him from throwing punches. And Douglas Lima, like, had to be pulled on top of him by Rory McDonald. Rory McDonald was like, come on, please, take the win. And then he fought Gegard Mousasi and just backed up the entire fight doing nothing. And then he fought Amosov and he did a similar thing. Meanwhile, Michael Page, one of the most interesting careers in MMA. I hope it doesn't become the standard because, you know, MVP has fought an awful lot of bus drivers and bin men, but except the odd fight. Like Paul Daly, hang on. So Fernando Gonzalez was like a 25-13 bum when Michael Page fought him. Teeth to the Junk was convinced that Fernando Gonzalez would beat Donald Cerrone at the time, which, you know, when was that? Donald Cerrone was probably still having good fights at that point. But he gets the split decision win over Fernando Gonzalez. He goes to box for a little bit. He beats Dave Rickles, who's coming up from lightweight. He beats Paul Daly by not really doing anything, but Daly's failing on takedowns. He fights Douglas Lima. Gets low kicked into, well, actually, no, we'll talk about the fight itself in a second. But then, the moment that he loses a fight, and he loses that undefeated record, he fights Richard Keeley, who was a 3-1, I believe, maths teacher. And this is the great one. This is how you know someone just is a full-on shit-eating wild man for Bellator, because they will try and justify it by being like, well, Keeley was talking mad smack online. And you're like, well, if that's a qualification, why am I not fighting John Volante? Why am I not in a main event? Absolutely absurd. Like, just they bring in this guy with four fights to fight a genuine world-class welterweight. Like, one of the probably the three, four best welterweights that Bellator's got, and that's probably their strongest division. Then he fights Gianni. Well, no, he's booked to fight Derek Anderson, another lightweight coming at the welterweight. He fights Gianni Melillo in London, who is not really anyone you should know. He fights Shinzo Anzai, a UFC dropout who he handily beats. Then he fights Ross Houston. And the really interesting thing is that he fights Ross Houston, who is good and is the... he'd just been the Cage Warriors champion. He'd just come off a great fight with Nicholas Dalby. He's a good fighter, but people were already convinced he was a bum because MVP was fighting him, and they know that MVP fights bums. And then he fights Derek Anderson and breaks his nose. But people now expect everyone that MVP fights to be a bum because they've done so much can crushing for him and record padding. But their first fight, MVP and Douglas Lima, was actually really promising. I thought MVP looked really good. He was getting in on Lima and getting away untouched. He did a nice... he did a couple of nice bursts in. He managed to walk Lima onto some stuff. I think Lima avoided the damage on the punches, but he managed to walk him onto them, or was trying to walk him onto them. And his issue was that he like went for a open stance. He shoots a left straight as he steps in, checking the lead hand. And then he went to try and like hit an outside reap or just like an outside trip. And he leaned in, but he didn't take him over. He just bumped into him and fell back onto his back. And Lima got on top of him and tried to hit him. And the first round was Michael Venom Page on the bottom of closed guard with a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt and supposed world-class ground and pounder on top of him. And he held double wrist control, and Lima couldn't do anything. He couldn't even turn over elbows on him, which is the thing when guys have got double wrist control. So he's impressively strong on the ground. But the second round, he goes to burst in. Lima times a good low kick, takes his leg out, and MVP tries to pop up like you do if you don't think you've really been knocked over. You go like, well, get up as quick as possible. Whereas if you'd been properly taken down, you might think about it a second before, you try and time your stand-up. But he hops up. Lima swings the longest Marge Simpson crumping uppercut I've ever seen. He says, guess who's going to jail tonight? And he turns his chin around like on the end of his reach. I mean, people got really mad at me for saying like that was quite a fortunate connection. But, it landed about the last place it could on his reach. And it landed just on the point of the chin as he was coming up with his head sideways. It was very strange because Lima didn't throw it to catch his chin and turn it sideways as his head was leaning over sideways on the end of his reach. He threw it just like blind as an uppercut. A punch is a punch. It still hits and knocks him out, but it was pretty crazy. So I'm quite interested in the rematch because I think MVP should be able to beat him, to be honest. Just got to keep moving around the ring. The downside is that, well, actually, I don't know, because I have seen MVP fight aggressively against decent fighters. He backed Paul Daly up almost immediately with feints. So if he can do that against Lima, just got to worry about that low kick. You know, it's quite interesting because it's the thing that's going to take out MVP anyway, because of his bladed side-on stance and his tendency to burst in. But it's also Lima's best weapon. You know, like he doesn't do enough of anything else. You just got to deal with that. I'd say, honestly, you're probably better off staying southpaw. Yeah, stay southpaw. Because he got caught coming... He'd get caught coming in orthodox. Yes, because it would have been right kick to his left leg. So, yeah, keep the right foot in front and just shoot him up like that is what I'd say. Move him to the fence. Obviously, you can try and time the flying knee when he ducks in, as MVP often tries to do. And I'm saying put him to the fence because I know that Lima hates... Well, will put his back on the fence and lose rounds. It's not that he hates it. It's that he's far too comfortable doing it. And his brother's the same in the UFC, Diego Lima. If you watch that fight with Bilal Muhammad, he just stands on the fence and lets... Like, I don't think Bilal Muhammad even had that much success taking him down. It's just that Bilal Muhammad could, like, throw tons of punches and then duck in on his hips to avoid a return because he was always on the fence. But... if you wanted to draw him out and fight him in the open, I suppose you could do that. I suppose the kick is a little bit more of a worry when you're not backing the dude up and there isn't a wall at his back. But then that's how Lima throws his kick anyway. He stands with his back to the fence and tries to kick. So yeah, worry about the kick. Maybe about the left hook, which is good when Lima throws it, but he's not been throwing it much lately. Do the MVP thing. Land some lancing left straights. Fuck around with some flying knees. Throw the odd high kick. I think people are going to be super salty if he wins, but he's world class. Like, he's a world class talent, and that's been my beef for the entire time. I don't want to watch world class talents assault bus drivers and bin men. I want to watch world class talents fight world class talents. And I also really begrudge the people who like laugh and clap when he's beating people who aren't even in the same league, and then try and advertise it as like an amazing win, you know, like Deep to the Junk with his Richard Keeley stuff. The best part was like people who were justifying the Richard Keeley match, and then afterwards were like, that's what you get! That's what you get, Richard Keeley! And you're like, you were the only person who thought this was a good matchup. And then the co-main event is Leah McCourt versus Jessica Borga. And I don't know shit about that. I've heard the name Leah McCourt, but I'm not going to sit down and watch B-League women's featherweight fights, to be honest. Fuck. Very little else on this. I mean, some of these lads might be good. I mean, I'm not going to hate you because you're fighting in Bellator, but they certainly aren't bringing out the big Bellator names for this card, is what I'm saying. Which is basically what the UFC used to do with London cards. They'd be like, yeah, fuck it. Here's Bisping versus... Well, actually, even Bisping got too good for London cards. But they'd give you one fight and then a load of just sort of filler. And speaking of filler, the UFC this weekend. Okay, Thiago Santos versus Johnny Walker. I mean, what do you want to... I mean, this should be Thiago Santos's fight to lose because in addition to being... a wild man who throws a lot of capoeira bollocks. He's also pretty competent. You know, he's pretty decent on the ground. He's pretty decent wrestling. And Johnny Walker is quite literally a meme fighter. You know, he does very well when he spazzes out on guys and they just sort of like, they want to engage so early that they walk onto his spinning back fist or whatever. I think there's this just general, or certainly there had been a general need to like get on Johnny Walker and show him you're a world-class fighter. And really, the way that he fights, the less you do early on, the more he's going to look shit later. His chances in the fight are you coming in on him and trying to like smother him or put him to the fence or beat him up or whatever. Just let him work a bit, you know? He'll look absolutely trash like in that Krylov fight. I mean, he looked awful against Ryan Spann, but Ryan Spann managed to gas himself out trying to take Johnny Walker out of there quickly. You know, you're going to try and Johnny Walker, Johnny Walker. But yeah, I mean, he rebounds straight into a UFC main event. So that's where we are with that. Kevin Holland versus Kyle Dorcas, Malorcas. Yeah, I mean, as long as Dorcas is willing to stand and bang, this will be a fun one. If he touches Kevin Holland's legs at any time, he'll get him to the mat. However, I do like Kevin Holland. When he's on his back, he does do a really... He has a really nice use of the armbar to get up, which is something you see... I mean, I talked about it a while ago with Charles Oliveira, how he uses the armbar as like an entrance point. You know, he's never finished a closed guard armbar. He got Darren Elkins with a triangle armbar, but that's different, completely different setup. But he does like the goes under the leg or grabs the back of the head and goes under the leg on the other side and he spins himself into the armbar. And guys will always pull their arm out because there's no control on the arm. But then he's like recenters and tries for the triangle. Or, you know, he gets the armbar and then they turn their arm and he goes into the omoplata. Or a lot of the times, and this is what Kevin Holland does, he will go for the armbar and just sort of like belly down without catching the end of the wrist or the forearm. You know, so you're doing the movement, but it basically just drags their arm across your body. So you basically roll over to a turtle position and the opponent's arm is still between your legs, but behind you, so you can stand up. Like, it's a really cool thing that Greg Jackson used to teach. He'd do like a platform armbar, which is where you cup your hand behind their elbow and then you dig on under the legs on the other side. But he'd advise guys to go for the armbar like you're going for it. Like, convince the opponent that you're going to try and tear their arm off. And as they pull their arm in or whatever, you just roll to your knees and get up. And Kevin Holland does that really well. He did it against, against Brunson and Vettori. So that Travis Luther jiu-jitsu, you know, the Michael Jordan of jiu-jitsu. Misha Serkinov versus Christoph Jocko. Cool. Is Jocko coming up for that one? Because he's a middleweight normally. Oh no, this is at middleweight. So Serkinov's going down. Had chin issues at 205, so he's going to dehydrate himself. That'll be interesting. Nico Price versus Alex Oliveira. Now this is interesting because a Patreon boy sent me a message saying you can get 36-1 odds on there being a point deduction in this fight. Which, I mean, you can't see, but I'm doing the money sign. It means taxes. That means taxes. Now, I'm tempted if I can find that on my bookie. But if I can find that on one of my bookies, I'm taking it because these guys are filthy fighters. It just depends who's reffing it. They haven't got the ref written down, have they? Hold on. No, refs are assigned on the night, so they haven't got it down. But elsewhere, it's sort of like, one fighter you know and then one fighter you're not really familiar with. Alexander Hernandez versus Mike Breeden. That's because It was Leo Santos originally, and Santos withdrew. Fucking Leo Santos, get your career back on track, mate. You're 42. We need you to make that title run. Jimmy Crute was on this fight. Was on this card against Jamal Hill that fell through. Sean Soriano versus Fernando Padilla, that also fell through. And then Diego Ferreira was fighting Grant Dawson, and apparently Ferreira's injured. That's a shame. But I'd put him above Dawson. I wouldn't think they're in the same sort of category. But yeah, you know, whatever. But Douglas D'Andrade is on the card. He's always fun and absolutely yoked. As I always say, he looks like the deprived class in Dark Souls. Jamie Mullarkey versus Devontae Smith. I like that. Jamie Mullarkey, if there's one thing he can do entertainingly, it's get hit in the head. That man has a chin that is worthy of spectating. Antonina Shevchenko is fighting an undefeated Scottish lass and has a good chance of losing, which is always good. Joe Selecki versus Jared Gordon. That's actually a good fight. And then Aspen Ladd versus Macy Chasson, who that's your standard UFC prospect versus prospect thing. But like, there aren't really a lot of prospects at women's bantamweight. Aspen Ladd is one of those fighters that I think if she can put it together, she's, you know, one of the few world-class fighters at bantamweight. But Macy Chasson's coming up. So yeah, lots to be going on with. It's one of those weekends with like a quantity of fights rather than like any that you're really excited for. So we've got a UFC, a Bellator, we've got three Cage Warriors, and there's normally good stuff on. There's normally a few good finishes on there and people to look out for. It'll be fun. And I'm going to call it there for today because me slaving in the content minds, I still managed to get an episode out with Walker versus Santos as the headliner. And we're all going to be mad when MVP beats Douglas Lima and inevitably fights. He's going to fight with Sassy next, of course, because he's a welterweight. I'm your boy, Jack Slack. You know where to find all my stuff. Go read the Jose Aldo Advanced Striking 2.0, and I will catch you on Monday. Cheers.